Welcome to episode 36 of Island CT Podcast.
A podcast about science, nature, technology, and education.
I'm Kelly.
And I'm Patrick. And together we are the hosts of the Island CT Podcast.
Okay, so today we are recording on May 21st. It is a Saturday, so we're a little late.
But not as late as last time.
Not as late as last time. Good thing. And
still using the Samsung. It's making life for us easier.
Yeah, especially for the editing.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I don't know. If we keep doing that, maybe we'll go for someday spend money on
a higher quality.
Although I think it's pretty good. I mean, it's nice for traveling, obviously. It's so small, but...
Right, it's handy the size. So.
Okay. What would you want to do?
So do you want to start with some biology?
Sure.
Okay. So one of the articles we both read about was the Venus flytrap. And it's out of the May 21st science or in-depth articles in Science. And I thought it was an interesting article. It was interesting to me to think about how these mechanisms that were in place for plant defensives, like phytotoxins and that, to fight off insects or other plants, were put into the development of making an offensive trap.
Yeah.
So I thought that was a very interesting way of putting it.
And I didn't see exactly. Do you know where the original research got published? Was that out of Nature or?
I did not see that.
No.
No.
There was not a huge amount about precisely what they did.
Mm-hmm.
I've got the impression the really big step forward is the granularity of the genetic responses that they measured, so they had a very much more precise understanding of what was happening.
Right, they were looking at certain genes being triggered to release certain chemicals.
Right.
Yeah.
I mean, I guess we should say exactly what they did.
Mm-hmm.
They allowed genus flytrap plants to eat flies.
Mm-hmm.
Crickets.
Crickets.
Genus cricket. Okay, yeah. And digest them, and then they measured the genetic response, like which genes were being turned on and turned mm-hmm. off all through this process.
Right.
And that's basically it. But yeah, it was really interesting. So there's little hairs on the genus, on the Venus flytrap.
Mm-hmm.
And I think a regular, meaning non-carnivorous plants, also have those hairs.
Mm-hmm.
And the response is a secretion of jasmonic acid,
mm-hmm.
which I think they didn't say exactly, or maybe I missed it, but I think that's an internal messenger.
Mm-hmm.
Like I think it's released into the vasculature
right.
of the plant, or maybe just into the cells, the intracellular space. I'm not sure.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, it causes release of, hydrolases to stop the toxins of the insects attacking them, and
mm-hmm.
and also hydrolases that dissolve chitin and other insects.
Right, can dissolve the insect.
Yeah, and in the Venus flytrap, it basically does exactly the same thing, except the amount released is just humongous amounts compared to what it would be in a non-carnivorous plant.
Mm-hmm. Right. So I thought it was an interesting article, and I would like to get more specifics on it.
I love
to dig into.
There was some part in there where he says, and we looked at the genes that were turned on like an hour later. And they're all the genes that you'd find in a root. And then it's like, that's mm-hmm. right. It's a root, basically, because it's absorbing whatever just got dissolved.
Yeah.
Just like roots do from the soil. So and it, I thought and, that was fun.
And I thought, you know, it's neat how, you know, Venus flytrap is found in poor quality soils.
Right.
So nitrogen would be a limiting factor
right.
that they would need to access, and getting it through animals would be one, you know, a huge
yep.
motivator
yep.
for it to shift to a more carnivorous
yep.
plant.
Yep.
So I thought that was a neat
yeah,
article.
Yeah, it's a cool article.
Mm-hmm. And my next, do you have one that's sort of along?
Do I have a I don't,
kind of ecology?
We have lots of biology this time.
We do. I have another ecology-based one
okay,
that
I don't
will
have...
not take too long.
Yeah.
So it's another one from the same science magazine, May 21st. And it is, sorry, May 13th. And it is on the effects of climate change on bird migration. And one of the articles starts out with the recent loss of up to 98% of some vulture populations.
Vultures?
Yeah.
Hmm.
And I...
This hasn't there been a big push in the last few years to bring back vulture populations
right.
in like Spain and India?
Right. Because of the important role they play.
And cleaning up
cleaning
the roads.
Up the roads. Yeah, they're great, you know, maintainer
yeah.
of an ecosystem. And they also mention about the bee populations declining. And the article is not, it does not show the research being done,
mm-hmm.
but it does give indications of what they're going to be doing in the upcoming years.
But isn't it a perspective?
It is.
Right?
It's a perspective.
And it says right there
yeah.
on page 819 of this issue. So there's a research article somewhere
there
in the paper.
I've read only the perspective. So, and they talk about how, you know, DDT affects, when it affects the insects, it has an overreaching effect of migrating birds. And then it talks about the red knots, and apparently with this climate change and the shorter seasons where they have periods of snow melt being shifted 2 weeks earlier,
mm-hmm.
that they're having populations, juvenile populations, with much shorter beaks.
Hmm.
And so they've noticed a huge change in the population, but they don't know if that population has disappeared, like as in no longer exists, or if they've found different migration pattern place to go to.
Right.
And they're going to have a new satellite up. They don't know, like it's not stated here. What's happening with that population.
Uh-huh.
But they talk about a new satellite that's going to be put up as a joint project. German and Russian space agencies are working together, and it'll be up next year. And it's called Icarus, and a system, and they'll be able to track migration patterns of birds and other things,
so,
and they hope to have more information
is
based on that.
Red knot mostly a European, African,
it's, oh, sorry.
Asian.
So the red knot is found in
in the Arctic.
Arctic.
Okay.
And it summers there, and then it migrates to tropical habitats around the world in the winter.
Okay.
So the shift in the climate in the Arctic regions.
They didn't put a map, did they?
No, they did not.
Okay.
Not in this one. So, anyway, the other thing is over the next 10 years, they hope to do more international biologging, where they hope to get observational information and use the satellite data to cross-reference what's happening to the migrating populations.
Hmm.
And I could see that happening, like as in more of a general citizen science project.
Yeah, yeah.
Being something that could be done through some of the apps on phones and things like that.
So the whole satellite, the Icarus system?
Yeah.
It's like, so it's, they want to track the animals by satellite.
Yeah.
How does that work?
I have no idea. They don't go into it here. But it's something that I hope we'll hear more about when it's up and running.
Yeah.
In 2017.
Right, right.
So, I'm going to be keeping my eye open for that now because I can imagine how it works, just like you're saying. I don't know if it's like the phytoplankton that they can track now and they track
it
using, you know.
That method with the two different fluorescence signals.
Yeah, exactly. Oh, sorry. They do have a map.
Oh, they have a map.
Pardon me. They do.
Okay, so it looks like it's going to, it's not obvious without reading the legend, but it looks like it's mostly Western Africa, down the west coast of Africa, all the way to the southern tip of Africa, and then Western Europe, but all the way up through above, I don't know, Archangel, and even further east. At the very northern end of Russia. Further east than the Urals, it looks like.
Mm-hmm.
And over Greenland? Yeah.
So, anyway, I think it will be interesting to see what happens, and it's something that I want to keep my eye open for later.
Cool. Well, as you were saying, yeah, I only looked at the perspective. I'm like, well, I'm actually not even, didn't even look at that. I'm just looking over your shoulder. Okay. Mine?
Yeah.
You have a choice. Well, the antibiotic we'll do together at the end, I guess.
Okay. Right?
Or, yeah.
It's pretty cool.
Yeah, that's the really cool. So I'll do mine. Mm-hmm. This one is about what's known as intraflagellar transport. It's on page 721 of the May 6th issue of Science.
Mm-hmm.
It's a report. Let me see. Ludek Stepanek and Gaia Pigino, Max Planck Institute of Molecular Cell Biology and Genetics in Dresden. Anyway, so I guess a little bit of background.
Mm-hmm.
Some cells have appendages on the surface called cilia.
Mm-hmm.
And some cilia can move, they have motors, and others don't. So we're looking here at, I think they were looking at cells in Chlamydomonas, which... Mm-hmm. I wrote a blog about, like, a long, long, I think it's blog number two or three.
Guys.
I love Chlamydomonas. I mean, I don't work with them ever, but
they're just pretty
they're
cool.
Very cool, the way they swim. So Chlamydomonas has two cilia, and they can use them for locomotion in three ways. They have, like, a breaststroke pattern, so that's when they're going supposedly forward, and they're happy.
Mm-hmm.
And then they can just twirl their cilia really fast in front of them in a long line and shoot backwards.
Like a squid. Mm-hmm.
So that's their, oh my gosh.
The squid motion.
Holy crap, let's get out of here motion. And then they can also put their cilia down flat on the ground. One straight out one way, one straight out the other.
They're more meditative pose.
They're meditative pose. Upside down, if you want, the cell sticking up in the air. And then they glide, I guess. You've seen this, right? They glide
the
along.
The yoga pose.
The yoga pose, exactly. And, well, since we're going along those lines, maybe I'll also mention they also intertwine their cilia when they make love.
Wow. Yeah.
So
they use cilia locomotion. For all they kinds use of things.
Yeah.
Okay.
So how do you build cilia? Well, cilia are filled with microtubules as opposed mm-hmm. to whatever. I'm not going to go into anything else because it gets really complicated. Mm-hmm. But cilia have a really well-defined structure. The ones that are locomotor cilia that they can move, they have in the center two normal microtubules.
Mm-hmm.
And then surrounding those, there's nine pairs of microtubules. And each pair, the microtubules are connected to each other.
Mm-hmm.
And one is a full true microtubule. Mm-hmm. So that's known as the A-tubule. Mm-hmm. And then one of them, and they have some diagrams, and mm-hmm. you can see one of them is only like a, if you cross-section it, it looks like a half moon instead of a full circle.
Right.
That's the B-tubule. So it's not a full microtubule. And so there's nine around the circle. And the microtubules are assembled so that the negative side is down towards the cell, mm-hmm. and the plus side is at the tip. Always. Right? That means that if you're going to build your cilium, mm-hmm. and they happen to always be built by adding stuff at the tip,
mm-hmm.
and taken back, you know, disassembled, for example, mm-hmm. by taking stuff off the tip.
Like root growth.
What's that?
Like root growth.
Yeah, exactly. Mm-hmm. You have to get the stuff all the way to the tip, mm-hmm. and then you have to bring it back. So there's constantly cargo moving down the cilium and back.
Uh-huh.
So towards the tip, we call that anterograde in the mm-hmm. forward direction, so to speak. And yeah. retrograde would be back towards the cell.
Mm-hmm.
So there's motors only go in one direction along microtubules.
Okay.
And what they call these trains that move in one direction or the other, they have to be moved along by motors. Mm-hmm. They don't just, you know. Turns out dynein is a molecular motor that is associated with motion on tubules towards the negative end. That's always the case.
Mm-hmm.
So that's back towards the cell, the retrograde motion. Turns out they use another motor called kinesin 2, if I remember correctly, when they go towards the tip, right? So stuff that's destined to go being assembled at the tip gets shoved on a kinesin. Kinesin walks along the microtubule to the tip, drops off its cargo.
Mm-hmm.
And then stuff that's at the tip that needs to be brought back, for example, the kinesins, which can't, you know,
mm-hmm.
they get stuck on dynein motors, which run in the retrograde motion towards mm-hmm. the negative end back towards the cell.
Got it.
Okay. Well, you can take movies of this, right? Mm-hmm. You can label things you know are going to end up in the cilium with different fluorophores like GFP. And you can see, I've seen movies of this, it's really cool. You see particles in fluorescence going along the cilium.
Okay.
And then coming back.
Mm-hmm.
What's really wild is what you never see. Sometimes what you see is you'll see two particles going in the same direction, and the one coming behind will be slightly faster and it'll catch up.
Oh, wow.
And then they'll merge and they'll go together.
Oh, wow.
Right? They won't pass each other ever.
Hmm.
So it means if they're going in the same direction, they're on some kind of a track.
Mm-hmm.
What you never ever see is a particle going in towards the tip, for example, another one shooting towards the cell.
In opposite direction.
In opposite direction. And then they come together. They just pass each other.
Mm-hmm.
They never just stop.
Oh, neat.
So.
But in the same direction, they always stop and join.
They don't stop.
Yeah, they don't stop.
They merge and keep going.
They merge. Like water droplets.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay.
And no one's understood. Well, it's not that there hasn't been an understanding. It's more like there's been theories about how do you stop the collisions, right?
Mm-hmm.
And no one's been able to actually show some hard evidence to say it's this mechanism versus that one. And obviously one way would be, well, one direction uses one set of microtubules, and the other one uses the other set of microtubules.
Right.
And this is what they did. And they did it. It's just absolutely amazing. You can see these IFT trains, intraflagellar transport trains, in EMs. But, of course, EM, you had to just freeze your structure. Mm-hmm. So you don't know which way it's going. You can see the fluorescence go back and forth, but that's really low resolution compared to your EMs. So you can't tell exactly where it is. You just know it's some, you know, it's kind of roughly on the psyllium, but in terms of those nine doublets around there, which one is it on? Who knows? But if you look at some of the images on there, in cross-section, you can see trains associated with the B-tubule or with the A-tubule. But which way was it going?
Right.
And so what they did, and they have an image on figure, it's figure 1B. It's a chymograph. Basically, a chymograph shows the flagellum at one point in time on one line. So you see fluorescence. And then on the next line, it's a little bit later. Next line, a little bit later. So stuff in their image, if it's going towards the tip, it starts on the left, and if the tip is towards the right, and it moves in time towards the right. So that would be a anterograde motion. And then back towards the cell would start at the right, and over time move towards the left, and that would be retrograde. And the really cool thing they did, which is absolutely amazing, is they were somehow able to suddenly, there's a pink arrow in their figure mm-hmm. B, 1B, where suddenly you see everything just stops and goes straight. They fixed it super fast, and then they kept that sample and they did EM on it, and they can match one particular line with a particular spot on an EM and know exactly where it is.
Oh, wow.
So they know the direction from this really low resolution chymograph that you have no idea where
right.
around the psyllium it is, to a particular spot on a cross-sectional EM that tells you exactly if it's on a B microtubule mm-hmm. or on an A microtubule. Anyway, so it's really amazing. And the upshot is, drumroll, if I remember correctly, if you're on the B microtubule, you're moving anterograde, going towards the tip, the incomplete one. I better triple check that because I'm doing it off the top of my head, and that's the most important thing. Let me see. GFP, blah, blah, blah. Let's see. I'm looking just to double check. Only anterograde trains were associated with the B microtubule. That's right. Mm-hmm. So it looks like on every doublet of microtubules, you have trains that go in both directions.
Neat.
But they're on two separate tracks. Mm-hmm. And there's different theories about how do they know, and it looks to me like the most likely is there's modifications of the microtubules.
That is really neat.
And they're different on the A and the B.
I did notice this article. Yeah. Didn't get around to reading it, but I thought, wow, that is pretty cool that they figured that out.
It's funny. It's that one of those you could totally miss, but because it's in the field, my work, mm-hmm. that I was like, wow, finally, we've got this figured out. Mm-hmm. And the expertise needed and the skill needed mm-hmm. to get those movies and be able to match up where that fluorescence is from a movie to where it is in an electron micrograph seems to me like that is quite a feat.
Yeah, I bet.
Yeah.
Very nice work.
Anyway, yep, very nice work. If you go all the way down to figure 3, they have some fantastic cross-sectional images mm-hmm. where, so it's like 3B, mm-hmm. you can see they took many, many cross-sectional images mm-hmm. and they have, I don't know, some like 50 of the fluorescence of all, just those going towards the tip, anterograde. and you see it's really dark towards a B tubule. Mm-hmm. And then you do like 50, well, I think it's more like 20 or so, where the particle was going retrograde towards the cell.
Mm-hmm.
And you see another dark motion, and they show an overlap, and you have the A in the B tubule, and there's no overlap in the color.
Nice.
And then next to it, in figure I, you can see, actually, the one that's really cool is above 3I. It's ENF. You can actually see there's a train in cross-section, there's a B tubule, and you can see little connections only to the B tubule.
Mm-hmm.
Both E and F show that. And then G and H, it's the same thing, but the it's for a train they know is going anterograde, and you have the A, and you see little connections to the A tubule, but mm-hmm. not to the B. So anyway, just ultra, ultra amazingly cool. Anyway.
Neat.
Okay, I'll be quiet now.
Calm
down.
That was a nice article.
It was cool.
Mm-hmm.
So.
Okay. So.
Antibiotics,
yeah.
Okay. So what do you think? So first we should say what it's about.
Okay. So I can do the overview since I read the shorter part. You read the
Oh, I see. You read...
I read a news release.
Gotcha.
So last week I read a news release. It had just been released from Nature on Wednesday. So mm-hmm. I can't remember the date, maybe 13th, maybe. And what they found is that researchers had found a new group of antibiotics.
Oh, that's not the one I was thinking about.
No?
Oh, I have a better one. Yes, you told me about this
one.
I remember
this. So they built a...
Okay, you go ahead. You go ahead.
Okay.
I'm thinking of a totally different one.
Are you? Oh, yeah, that's so funny. I thought we were talking about
the same
one.
Mine's better than yours. Anyway, go ahead.
Okay.
Do your lame one. I'll do my awesome one.
Thank you. So there's these this course of antibiotics or this group of antibiotics
uh-huh.
that's called the macrolides,
uh-huh.
and that includes erythromycin and azithromycin. So there's this class, this has been around since the 1950s, and this is, you know, when they tried to, when this group came together, they were thinking, okay, they're going to build a new drug based on this one. And the way they were going to do it is they were going to change just one bond of a larger molecule. And when multiple bonds reacted, the results caused a mixture of the end product. So they had nonspecific antibiotic mm-hmm. that was useless because mm-hmm. it wouldn't have helped anyone. So to solve this problem, some chemists from Harvard, Andrew Meyer and his colleagues, they started with three basic macrolides rings structures and broke each one down into eight molecular modules. And then they carefully mapped out the reactions. I can't imagine how much work this took. Map out the reactions that were needed to put the pieces back together.
Hmm.
Isn't that amazing? For me, I was just like, how would you even go about this? But anyway, for two such linkers, they even invented new chemical reactions to forge the bonds just at precise locations, which I thought was pretty cool. And because of that, they were allowed to tinker with modules individually and then reassemble them. And by repeating this strategy over and over, they forged 300 entirely new macrolides. Now, that's pretty cool. But then when they did a panel of bacterial lab cultures, several of these compounds showed potential for antibiotic activity against antibiotic-resistant microbes. Isn't that cool? And it's the ones like Staphylococcus.
Staphylococcus aureus. Which is, isn't that...
That's huge.
That's the one that gets...
That's hospital...
Multi-resistant.
MRSA. Yeah. Anyway, I just thought it was pretty neat. So, mine's pretty cool, even though you don't think it's as cool as yours.
Yeah, it's pretty cool. Well, anyway. It's interesting because why are some of these... This is something that's been going on forever, this fight between bacteria and fungi and other things, which is part of what I'm going to go on to. But, you know, what makes a lot of these antibiotics difficult for, at least initially, for the bacteria to deal with? And it's because of these really freaky, weird reactions, like forming rings out of peptides and stuff that just normally you wouldn't do. And the only reason that it's done, presumably, is because there's evolutionarily a drive for making stuff that other creatures can't deal with.
Right.
Is the point.
So it's actually using a mechanism that bacteria use to fight each other.
Right.
The antibiotics.
Yeah.
So,
Or that fungus uses to fight bacteria
fungus,
more likely.
So here's the other thing is that, it's nice to have breakthroughs like this because right now the research funding that's being put into antibiotics is going down and fewer companies are trying to pursue research in antibiotics because they don't get the...
I had this interesting idea.
The turnover.
Go ahead.
And this group, because of the success they've had, they're actually starting up a pharmaceutical
and just for making
cool. their antibiotics, and I'm very excited for them.
Yeah.
Anyway, nice.
Yeah. So mine is it's a kind of a news piece out of the May 13th issue of Science. Mm-hmm. It's on page 758. Mm-hmm. And it talks about several... It's kind of like a movement now in research to try to find out new ways to deal with antibiotic resistance because it's getting so bad.
I did read this too.
Did you? Okay.
Yes. But I didn't look it up today. Okay.
So, and the whole concept is that one thing that I love, one way of looking at it is, this is skipping to kind of like the end point of the article, is that classically, we've thought of antibiotics as a way of killing bacteria.
Mm-hmm.
And that's just a poor way to look at it because antibiotics have been around forever, for millennia. And they don't talk about it, but I think it's mostly fungi that use them in their fight with bacteria. And so bacteria have resistance already to practically everything you can think up. It's just not a large part of the population.
Right.
Because there's a fitness cost to maintaining this, the molecular machinery to deal with these funky compounds that are out there trying to kill you. And if they're not around, you don't want to deal with them. And so the correct way to think about this is more as antibiotics as selecting agents.
Mm-hmm.
In evolution.
Right.
Because on the order of multiples of 20 minutes, let's say.
Right.
Bacteria are evolving. Well,
right.
We're not.
Mm-hmm.
And so some of the upshot is of this research is that for the first time, we actually are showing that... it is better sometimes to not use antibiotics in the way that they'd normally be used according to standard medical practice, meaning you hit the person really hard with antibiotics and keep it going for as long as you're absolutely sure that all of the
bacteria
are gone, the ones that are pathogenic, right? And the other one is to do the multiple antibiotic treatment, which is something that tends to be done with tuberculosis. And I don't think they're saying don't do it with tuberculosis, but, you know, the idea that that may be a way of fighting the resistant strain might be a really bad idea.
Wow.
Yeah. So, here's the type of thing that they're finding. Basically, experiments in mice. You give an infection, and then you give some mice a really high dose of antibiotics. You give some a lower dose, and then you see what happens. And it turns out that a lot of times you get the higher dose, and the mice die, and the ones that you give a lower dose survive. And you also see what the bacterial load is, and you analyze the bacteria to see, you know, what's different about them.
Mm-hmm.
And the theory that's coming out of this is that if you give high doses, usually, not always, usually, there's already bacteria that are going to be resistant to that there, because it is, resistance is everywhere. But the number of those bacteria are pretty low as a fraction of what's infecting the animal. So you give high doses, you kill off all the bacteria that were competing with the ones that were resistant and which were at a disadvantage. Now suddenly you have what they call, is it competitive release, I think, where you kill off the competitors, and so now the resistant bacteria grow out of control.
Right.
Take over the organism, and the organism dies. You give low dose, you slow down bacterial growth. You slow it down the same for the ones that are resistant as the ones that are not as resistant. And the immune system has time, or maybe that doesn't make sense, does it? But you'd slow it down for the ones that are not resistant, but there's so many of them compared to the ones that are resistant that that's okay. So I guess that's what they're saying. You give time to the immune system to catch up.
Right.
And the immune system is really good at this type of stuff. And so then the immune system clears the infection because the resistant ones haven't had a chance to grow out of control.
Right.
Yeah, so, and it gets a little bit more complicated and stuff. And, you know, I love this article because I've heard about this type of stuff as a concept for a long time. And my response has always been, yeah, well, show me two things. Show me a mechanism.
Right.
And show me data that that's true. And I haven't seen it. I've been like, it's a, whatever. Because the original idea of Fleming and penicillin makes so much sense that, you know, if you don't really kill them fast, you don't hit them hard, some of them eventually will develop resistance. But now there's data showing, no, that's not the case. And
right.
the mechanism makes a lot of sense. The resistance is already there.
Right.
And there's all sorts of just backlash against them, it seems, with no data behind it. And it's like, you know, I love this one phrase that I read. Let me see. Them fighting conventional views. Oh, I can't find it. It was so good. Where is this? I really have to
There's
say.
There's a big quote.
Oh, here it is.
Says.
Here it is. Reed's argument is fundamentally fallacious because it assumes there is a safe way to undertreat infection. There isn't. Well, if you give really high levels of antibiotics and you get you develop resistance and that kills you, yeah, there's no safe way to overtreat either.
Right.
Right? You're screwed. I mean, it's not, it's arguing from the sake of, like, passion. It's like when you hear someone say, really, really?
Mm-hmm.
It means they have no argument. Mm-hmm. I really have to say that the outcome of this is that the people that are doing this research are saying it's way more complicated than the simple view of before. And the people that's fighting it seem to want it to have it the old way, one way. And they're totally going to be right about some infections, right? There's some infections you're going to want to hit really hard, really fast. But you're going to kill people if you don't know the difference.
Exactly.
And they're those guys doing the research are the only ones that are actually trying to figure this out. So
yeah, I like that the way they're going about it.
Yeah.
Very interesting. It takes a lot of work to change a system.
Yeah.
That's been instilled for the last, I don't know how many.
Mostly, I'm really excited for seeing. So they have some interesting mathematical models that are both supporting and going against what they're saying. And it'll be really interesting to see when they finally are able to differentiate between different types of infections and are able to model them and say, yes, this matches this model, this matches this other model, this is why they're different. Then we're going to find out about some really new biology that, you know, on a system level, what makes these infections different.
Right.
That'll be really cool. Anyway, believe it or not, in terms of science, that's all I have. I had there's a neat wave energy one out of, I think it's May 6th, I think. Yeah, which is interesting. I'm not going to talk about it, but it looks like they're making progress after lots of setbacks, coming up with new systems. I didn't realize UK is really huge on wave energy. From the article, it looked like they were like so far ahead of anybody else in terms of actually testing this out.
I had no idea.
I closed everything else. That's about.
I only have a very short article about Fukushima.
Okay.
And it's actually the data, what has been looked at by Joseph Shepard, a mechanical engineer at the California Institute of Technology, and who chairs the academic committee that looked at the findings of what happened at Fukushima, right? Hmm. So what they found is that they were very lucky with Fukushima, and that it could have been much worse if the spent fuel had not been cooled partially during the meltdown. Mm-hmm. So during the meltdown, they were trying to put water in there, and they were using everything that they could to do it. But they're like, you know, that meltdown came so close to being something that could have just totally cleared out an entire area.
Mm-hmm.
And it's really good that, you know, that this particular study was done, because now it's making them rethink, you know, where should this spent fuel be kept and how should it be kept?
Mm-hmm.
And one of the things was the spent fuel that was kept was still hot. And so it should be cooled much more before it is stored on the site.
Right.
And then, I'm speaking very superficially because I don't know the whole, of the story, but this one part that was just released yesterday sounded so interesting. And I think we'll have more reports coming out. But, the finding, has promoted that or has, caused the nuclear, I don't have their thing. Anyway, the United States, nuclear plants to rethink of how they're storing that spent fuel. And Some plants in the United States had been storing the spent fuel on site the very same way as the Fukushima.
Yeah. And I think pretty much all. I mean, there's the way you store it and whether you store it on site.
Right.
I think most plants nowadays still store it just on site.
Right. So they're thinking of removing this as quickly as possible off-site so that they
either way, you have to find a place for it somewhere.
Well, and that's what I was going to end with. For them, for just in the United States, for them to be able to take all of the on-site, unspent spent fuel, and remove it, it would cause United States plants $4 billion.
Hmm. Yeah.
So, obviously, it's not going to happen tomorrow.
Yeah.
But it's something that they have to think through of.
Do you remember seeing the pictures of all of this water stored on site at Fukushima? Mm-hmm. Because they're still trying to keep it cool. Or... It's not that they're trying to keep it cool, or I can't remember, but they have a problem with water leaking in, right?
Right.
So they're pumping water out all the time. I don't know whether they're still pushing water in, but they're trying to pump the water out continuously so it doesn't mix with the water outside.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know how radioactive that water is.
I'm not sure. But anyway, interesting finding.
Yep.
And I love how it's an international group looking at it, as a, nuclear plants internationally are looking at how things are set up, what happened, and evaluating how is this, how is our situation similar? What can we do to renegotiate this so that's a safer setup? So
I think
that's
all of our science stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Don't have any programming IT stuff this time.
Okay.
Didn't look any. Or I might have, but then I forgot. Should I take a super quick look?
Sure.
I don't remember. Opinion, open source, beyond code and license. That was interesting, but I don't remember enough about it. Secrets of GIMP.
Nice.
So, FossPix. Oh, FossPix had some really cool stuff about video imaging. And not video imaging, but stitching images and stuff.
Nice.
But I'll have to leave it because it's a while since I looked at it and I won't remember. Anyway, so let's move to our stuff.
Okay. So we have an Art of Meat coming up next Saturday.
Our blog entries.
And our blog entries are actually
all about
AR. All about Art of. And mine focused on Art of 80 meter, how to use an 80 meter receiver.
Yep.
And it was meant to be set up as quick notes for the people showing up to our events so that they have some notes to look at when they're out there and trying to think of all the things that they're supposed to be thinking of and listening to the transmitters that are going off every 5 minutes.
Yeah. No, I thought you put pictures of the transmitters and marked that. I think that was really good. I just realized that you're doing a separate one to give to them. And in the blog entry, you also had a map that it showed where the start was, and you talked about that. But I'm thinking that should not be part of the notes. They're going to have a map, and we're going to be telling them there.
Yeah.
We're going to be taking them to the start like we did last time.
Right.
So that should probably be not part of their...
Yeah. So on the blog, it's not set up in a nice, neat table. No. They'll be receiving a nice, neat table just because a table will help them
And
separate the information a little better.
That we do a project page for this.
Oh, yeah.
Right? That mm-hmm. makes a lot more sense.
Yeah.
So, I mean, I thought it was a cool blog entry because it's pertinent now.
Yeah.
I find a lot of times that I have a blog entry and then it becomes something just for myself later on,
mm-hmm.
notes about something and I change it.
Right.
So, you know, I'm not going to talk about my blog entry. It was about course setting for mm-hmm. our last one, and we talked about it during the last podcast.
Okay.
And then I wrote the blog.
I've done that before,
afterwards,
too.
So it's all the same.
Okay.
There's a few other things. Have you been doing anything?
Nothing.
Except talking to kids and stuff. You are going through EOG craziness.
Right.
So end of school and... I have been building like mad, mm-hmm. desperately trying to get 3 more transmitters built so we can replace our big ones that are so difficult to go running in the woods with.
Mm-hmm.
But I did change the boxes of the enclosures for the 3 big ones so that the 2 of them that were in like these thin plastic shoe boxes are now in real enclosures. That's a big step.
Uh-huh.
And fixed up all the antennas and stuff, almost all of them. But yeah, it'd be nice to have smaller transmitters. Mm-hmm. And it's been like one just bad thing happened after the other.
Right.
I had all sorts of problems with the switches. And then just now, just like a few hours, just a couple hours ago, I think. Or no, just less than like an hour ago.
Right.
I finally got the SI-5351 on one of the transmitters to work after mm-hmm. working at it for several days. And, yeah, I had to replace it, replaced all different parts. And so, anyway, so we're on our way. I don't know if they'll be ready by May 28th, but mm-hmm. we'll see. But what's really exciting about this meet?
Oh, this meet, it is going to be open to all middle schools.
And we already have one person
signed up.
And we
have a person signed up. Woohoo!
Yeah.
And so that's exciting.
That is very exciting.
Yeah. And we have a few people that have been talking about going, so I'm also excited.
Yeah, we have
about that.
Quite a few people, mm-hmm. I think, that have said they're going to go. So.
Mm-hmm. And tomorrow we have an O-meet.
We have an O-meet. Mm-hmm. Yep. Dave Waller is putting it on,
mm-hmm.
and he did a lot of the mapping for the ones we're using for the aircraft.
Yeah.
That's kind of cool.
Which is really nice. It's wonderful to have great maps to use.
Anyway, I think we are ready to wrap up.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, thank you for listening to the Island CT podcast.
Make sure you check out our blog.
Goodbye.
Goodbye.